The Guardian.
Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast, brought to you in association with Squarespace. To find out more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
Now, naturally, people want to know what Brexit will mean.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means breakfast.
Breakfast. Brexit.
So in closing, I'd simply say this. Brexit means Brexit.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian's brand new Brexit podcast. Brexit means... I'm John Henley. Coming up in this episode, we're talking Article 50. What does it say? How does it work? And who gets to trigger it? Will it result in a hard-boiled Brexit or a soft one? Clean or messy? Black, white, grey, red, white and blue? Or even a Hotel California Brexit? You can check out anytime you like, but you can never really leave. Well, to get their teeth into all of this, I'm joined by Jolyon Moore, a QC who is involved in the legal challenge to the government's use of Article 50, by our own legal correspondent, Owen Bocott, and on the line by Philip Serpis, who's Professor of EU Law at Bristol University. And later on, we'll be joined by our Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin. Now, before we get started, a little bit of background. Before the EU's Lisbon Treaty was ratified in 2008, there was no formal way to leave the bloc. When Greenland left in 1982, it had to do so by a unanimous agreement with the other member states. Article 50 was conceived then as part of the EU constitution, which was rejected by member states and eventually re-emerged as part of the Lisbon Treaty. So it's a relatively new provision, and crucially, it's never been invoked before. So what does Article 50 actually say? Well, it's quite long. I'll give you the key points. Number one is, any member state may decide to withdraw from the Union in accordance with its own constitutional requirements. That's clearly crucial. Number two, the agreement of departure terms shall be concluded on behalf of the Union by the European Council, acting by a qualified majority after obtaining the consent of the European Parliament. Point three, the treaties shall cease to apply to the state in question from the date of entry into force of the withdrawal agreement, or failing that, 2 years after notification, unless the European Council, in agreement with the member state concerned, unanimously decides to extend this period. And that's basically it. Now, during the referendum campaign, David Cameron was quite clear. If Britain voted to leave, he would activate Article 50 straight away.
You activate Article 50.
You're going to activate that immediately.
It takes
to activate that immediately.
That is what, if British people vote to leave, that's what we should do.
On the 28th of June, you will activate it at the European Council.
That's what we have to do.
But in the event, he held off.
A negotiation with the European Union will need to begin under a new Prime Minister. And I think it's right that this new Prime Minister takes the decision about when to trigger Article 50.
And it wasn't until October that Theresa May finally announced her own timetable.
We will invoke it when we are ready, and we will be ready soon. We will invoke Article 50 no later than the end of March next year.
Since then, though, the government has lost a case in the High Court, and unless it's overturned by the Supreme Court, we'll have to put a bill before Parliament to get consent for triggering Article 50. Owen, you sat through the first hearing in the High Court. Can you explain, sort of in layman's terms, really, why the government lost in the High Court and what it did differently when it presented its case to the Supreme Court?
They were very long hearings and confused probably most any lay people who were listening to the Supreme Court hearings outside. The government tended to rely on very rather old, fusty case precedents, which didn't convince the judges in the High Court that the royal prerogative, essentially the old powers derived from the monarchy, which now constitute, as the government would say, their powers for executive action in emergencies, would extend to being able to revoke, effectively, a law passed by Parliament. And the judges found fairly, well, in the High Court, by a majority of 3-1, that the historical precedents and modern case law, essentially, was that Parliament needed to be consulted if it was going to uproot the European Communities Act of 1972, which formally took us into what was then the EC and gave lots of rights to individual citizens. They tried to stress in slightly differently in the Supreme Court case that the royal prerogative was not some fusty old battle axe held at the back of a cupboard, which is rarely brought out and used, but they suggested it was a modern, gleaming, digital age implement for taking executive action in the fast-moving modern world, and it shouldn't be seen in the light of all these ancient acts. But other than that, they roughly kept to the same score.
Jolyon, is that the impression that you got as well?
Yeah, I mean, I broadly agree with Owen's analysis. I think the reality of the situation is that although they put their case more nicely in the Supreme Court, fundamentally it was the same case. Your second question, you allude to the possibility that the government might have won by revising Theresa May's maxim, Brexit means Brexit, to Brexit may mean Brexit. In other words, if they had said, look, when we trigger Article 50, this is not a bullet that leaves the chamber, it's some other metaphor whereby this putative bullet could actually be recalled to the chamber should the government decide that that was politically desirable. And if they had run that argument, then the contention put by Ms. Miller and others, this is Gina Miller, who along with the People's Challenge and a few other people brought the original case. So her contention was that when Article 50 was triggered, it would inevitably lead to rights accruing to individuals as EU citizens being lost, including the right to vote in European elections and stand as an MEP and so on and so forth. The government had a counter to that, and the counter was to say, well, actually, really, all Article 50 does is open a conversation with the EU. We may, at the conclusion of that conversation, decide to leave, but we may, some way through that conversation, decide that we don't want to leave at all. Article 50 is not a bullet fired from a chamber, it's just the opening of discussions. The problem for the government is that if they had run that point, it would have led to a reference being made to the Court of Justice of the European Union on the question whether we are having a conversation or firing a gun.
Yes, and there would have been a certain irony, at the very least, in that, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's a point that's made quite vigorously, but I think it's really, really important that we get clear what is actually at stake with that reference. There are two questions. There's a legal question. What does Article 50 mean? What rights does the member state triggering Article 50 have? But alongside that, there's a profoundly more important political question. So if you assume that somehow the Court of Justice of the European Union gets to decide this question of the revocability of Article 50, it still leaves the important question, which is a political question for our democratically elected parliament. Do you actually want to revoke Article 50? And it is that act that might be characterised, were the government to take it, as stopping Brexit. Answering the legal question simply unlocks the door. It empowers Parliament to make a political decision if Parliament wants to make it.
I mean, just very briefly, how did you rate the two opposing teams in the Supreme Court? I mean, there were some fairly spectacular performances, weren't there?
Well, if you are the sort of person who has pin-ups of lawyers on your bedroom wall, A, you probably live alone. But B, many of the pin-ups will have been in that Supreme Court courtroom. So two very contrasting styles. Lord Panic, who is every lay observer's idea of what a brilliant barrister does. Short, pithy, punchy, forceful points. And against that, the much more conversational style of James Edie. I'm, as an advocate, much more like Panic, but I very much aspire to be a James Edie. You want to communicate this relaxed, confident, conversational style where you really engage with the points that the judges are making. That's absolutely what James Edie tries to do. Panic beats them over the head and hopes they raise their hand and surrender, and very often they do.
Okay. Philip, what's the significance of bringing the devolved parliament into the Supreme Court hearings?
Yeah, I mean, that adds a whole other dimension to the issue. The question before the High Court was about the relationship between prerogative and parliament. If you bring in the devolved assemblies as well, then the issue is sort of which parliament it is that is going to be able to make the final decision. So if the court were to agree that parliament needs to be involved, there is a subsidiary question about the extent to which that should also involve participation by the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly, and the Northern Irish Assembly as well. And I think that the scope there is for the process to become more complicated and for Theresa May's negotiating hand, if you like, to become more tightly controlled, because she will not only have to listen to voices at Westminster, she will also have to listen to voices in the devolved assemblies as well.
And how likely do you think that is to happen, or is it impossible to say?
My sense from listening to the arguments and from what I know about the constitutional arrangements is that if push comes to shove, ultimately the decision is one for Westminster to take. There are various conventions that suggest that normally the devolved assemblies will be given a say, but I suspect if push comes to shove that Westminster will be able to overrule any objections that there may be. All this, though, will make the constitutional settlement in the UK a lot more complicated. If the Scottish Parliament, for instance, views are overlooked, then I think that will enhance the demands for another referendum in Scotland.
Okay. Joe, you have recently launched separate legal proceedings in the Irish High Court. Tell us what that's about.
Well, there are a number of things that those proceedings seek to accomplish. I spoke earlier about this possibility of revocation. If you look at the process of the referendum and you compare it to an estate agent's particulars full of promises about what it is that you will find if only you go to visit, you're very keen to offer to the electorate an opportunity to buy the house, not on the basis of the particulars, but on the basis of their viewing of that house. Of course, if the house matches the particulars, you may very well want to buy it. If, on the other hand, the estate agent has missed out this large motorway encircling your otherwise beautiful villa, it may be that the electorate comes to change its mind about the desirability of Brexit. If Article 50 can be revoked and the electorate does not like this house, it will knock on the doors of its constituency MPs and say, look, this is not a good thing. Don't make us do this. We're going to lose our jobs. We can't afford to pay the bills. And so really I'm trying to create an analogue for the situation that exists in a general election, where if assurances are given, those assurances are not acted upon, the public has the chance to speak again. So it feels to me, at least, like a profoundly democratic move. There are a couple of other elements to it as well. One is that unless Parliament has the opportunity to reject the deal that the government strikes in Brussels, Parliament has no control over that deal at all. Because if you assume, let's just take for the sake of argument this scenario, Parliament decides that it will impose all sorts of conditions on the government in its Article 50 negotiations. Those all form part of the act that the government has to adopt following, let us assume, a successful defence of her High Court decision by Gina Miller and the People's Challenge and others, and assume that the Brexiters go over to Brussels and they don't really like any of these conditions that Parliament has imposed, and those horrid foreigners won't give in. So they just negotiate the deal that suits their needs, which is Brexit at any cost. Just make that assumption. They then come back to Parliament. What does Parliament do? If it cannot revoke the notification, it has the choice of accepting that deal, shooting itself in the foot, or it can exit without any deal at all, shooting itself in the head. That is not a viable alternative scenario. So without Article 50 being revocable, Parliament is left with no control at all over the acts of the executive. Again, that feels like a profoundly undemocratic state of affairs.
So your action really is about creating a situation whereby the so-called blank check could in fact be torn up by Parliament.
I want Parliament to take back control.
Can I come in there on the reversibility of Article 50? I know Jolien and I have both written about this, and I think it is absolutely crucial for the reasons that Jolien has just given for the question to be clarified. The assurance that Parliament will get a vote at the end of the process is meaningless if the option of remaining in the EU cannot be put back on the table, or sorry, not remaining in the EU, but reversing the notification cannot be put on the table.
No, but I mean, just to come back on that, though, is, I mean, can you explain, Philip? I mean, because a lot of people seemed to assume that once MPs, a very clear majority of MPs in Parliament voted in favour of triggering Article 50 in March, voted in favour of the government amendment. So that what you're saying really is that this shouldn't be the so-called blank check, that this is the political process must not now be over.
I mean, there are two questions. One is who should be involved in triggering Article 50, and that appears to be being settled by the High Court. The next is what options are there once Article 50 has been triggered, and that is a question of interpretation of Article 50, which, as Jolene has said, is a question for the European Court of Justice ultimately. And I suspect, I'm not sure whether Jolene's litigation will be successful or whether there will be a reference made to the Court of Justice in that particular case. But I rather think that before the end of the process, some court, some somewhere will decide to make a reference to the Court of Justice about whether or not Article 50 is revocable or not. And I think that is an absolutely crucial question to be determined. Otherwise, we are left with a choice of shooting ourselves in the foot or the head.
Jolene.
I mean, I think those are very fair points. There is absolutely no guarantee that the case that will be issued in Dublin before Christmas, we think, will succeed in establishing the revocability of Article 50. Two things have to happen. The Irish court has to form a view that these are appropriate questions to refer. And in part, that will depend upon the Irish court's assessment of the desirability for it and for the EU of having answers to those questions. The law is not a formal slide rule. It's a thing that you can only understand when you view it in its political context. It's also possible, of course, that the Court of Justice, faced with a reference from Ireland, may decide it doesn't want to answer those questions. And if it doesn't want to, it is possible that it will just say we don't need to answer those questions. So it again will have to form an assessment about the desirability. But those are fair points. They're fairly made. But they don't have the consequence that this is the wrong course of action to pursue. All of us, including Brexiters, should want legal certainty. If the court were to say that Article 50 was irrevocable, that would pretty much put an end to calls for a second referendum.
I mean, that's the other point I was going to make, is that it's not at all clear how the Court of Justice, if it decides to entertain the question, how it would actually decide it. There are strong arguments, I think, on both sides. Some people have argued that Article 50 is indeed irreversible. Others prefer the view that it is reversible. And there are also intermediate positions that suggest that the UK might be able to reverse its notification, but only with the agreement of a qualified majority or all the other member states of the EU. Mm. So I think that there are layers of uncertainty around the reversibility of Article 50.
Yeah. Owen, is there any uncertainty at least about when we can expect the Supreme Court's decision?
The guidance they were giving was before the end of January. So we should know before the end of January. There were 11 justices, so getting them all together whilst they're looking at other cases, I suppose, takes some time. But I'm sure they're very conscious of the political urgency out there and will try and deliver it as soon as they can. But they'll probably still be reflecting on it as they digest their Christmas puddings in port, or whatever.
And how detailed can we expect their sort of instructions to actually be?
There's a little bit of uncertainty. If they find for the government, then they will find for the government. But if, as expected, they go the other way, the High Court, in its judgment, didn't say, it merely said it was a matter for Parliament and left it open as to whether it should be a motion or a bill. And there's obviously been a motion now in the Commons, at least. The Supreme Court was coming under pressure and requests from various parties that if it was going to make a decision against the government, it will probably, recommend there should be a short bill. But they're also being told that by some politicians that if they do so, they are trespassing on what are purely political matters. So it gets very sensitive.
Jolyon.
There is also this further idea floating around that our constitution may require real parliamentary engagement. I mean, if you're like me and you're sitting back and you're thinking about how we bring the country back together when all this is done, you're recognising that perhaps the only institution that can do that is Parliament. And when the Supreme Court says, assuming the Supreme Court says, that Parliament has to trigger Article 50, you might expect it to say that Parliament needs not merely a formal role, but an actual substantive role. And one of the very, I think, unfortunate responses of the government to this challenge has been to say, look, even if an act of Parliament is required by our constitution, we will do the bare minimum, the formal minimum, to meet that requirement. We do not recognise that Parliament has any legitimate role to play in the process. And that's the sort of stance that drives the country further apart rather than, which a responsible government should be doing,
and
brings
together.
It together.
Okay, well, you can follow all the machinations of the Supreme Court and the rest of the Brexit news at theguardian.com/politics/EU-referendum, where you can also sign up to my weekly Brexit briefing email every Tuesday morning.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Now, if and when the government extracts itself from the legal challenges to its activation of Article 50, there will, of course, come a time Theresa May formally approaches the other EU27 member states and gives them notice that Britain is actually leaving. From that moment, a two-year countdown will start ticking and Brexit is underway. What will happen then? On the line now is The Guardian's Jennifer Rankin. Jennifer, let's throw things forward to March then, assuming it is March, and Theresa May delivering her notice to Brussels that Britain's activating Article 50. What actually happens then?
Well, let's assume that Theresa May does trigger Article 50 by the end of March, as she's promised to do so, and the notification arrives sometime before the stroke of midnight. That doesn't mean that negotiations will begin immediately. Instead, she'll have a response from the EU side, most likely from Donald Tusk, the President of the European Council, who will then set up a meeting with the EU's 27 remaining countries in order to thrash out their negotiating position. And this could take anything between 1 to 2 months. So it's going to mean a delay to the start of real negotiations as the EU27 thrash out their red lines and what their negotiating mandate could be.
Right. And I mean, I understand Michel Barnier, who's sort of the Commission's chief negotiator, he'll be leading the negotiations, and he's already been visiting lots of the EU capitals, sort of sounding out their positions.
Yes, Michel Barnier will be the chief negotiator. He'll be the face of the Brexit negotiations for the EU27, and he's been around many of the capitals already, finding out what they want to guarantee from these negotiations. But the overall decisions will ultimately be made by EU leaders working in summits and through their Sherpas and senior diplomats. So there are quite a lot of moving parts and personalities will be involved in these negotiations.
Yeah. And I mean, are there kind of likely to be any key players that you know, listeners in Britain will simply not have heard of? I mean, who really will be the playmakers in the Brussels game?
Well, I think certainly Michel Barnier, who's already now well known in the UK, but also another person to watch would be Didier Sayers. He will be one of the leading players working on behalf of member states to ensure that their interests are represented. He's a Belgian diplomat. He's worked for a long time in the EU Secretariat as well as the Belgian government. So he's well able in the sort of art of making a fine compromise.
Mm. Philip, can you explain a little bit? Once Article 50 is triggered, what is the UK's actual status within the bloc? And what will happen also to the British employees, the British nationals who work for the Commission or British MEPs? I mean, we've seen that you know, at the summits, recent summits, Theresa May has been sort of effectively excluded or asked to speak very late on. I mean, is Britain effectively out in the cold, or does it have any part to play in this?
I think there's a big difference between the legal position and the political position. In legal terms, the UK remains a full member of the EU until the date of the withdrawal. In political terms, I think you're absolutely right that there is evidence already that the UK has been sidelined and probably will continue to be sidelined. There might be new pieces of legislation being proposed, which everyone assumes will come into force in a couple of years' time, at which point the UK won't be part of the EU, everyone presumes. So what sort of involvement would the UK expect to have in that process? I suspect not very much. Mm. Well, one area where legally the UK is already sidelined or will be sidelined is in relation to something which I think is quite significant, which is the guidelines which the European Council is said to produce according to paragraph 2 of Article 50. These are the guidelines in the light of which any withdrawal agreement is negotiated and concluded. Mm-hmm. And it's made explicit in Article 50 that the withdrawing state, so the UK, will not be involved in the setting of these guidelines. And one thing that I hope for from this process is that these guidelines will begin to shed some light on how the negotiation will be conducted. So they might, for instance, refer to the reversibility or otherwise of Article 50. They will talk about the relationships perhaps between the Commission, the Council and the European Parliament. They could also talk about the scope of any withdrawal deal. So what the relationship is between the withdrawal deal and any future relationship that the UK might have with the EU and any possible transitional arrangements in between. And they might also talk about the ratification procedures. So I expect that Parliament will be involved in the UK. There's a lot of uncertainty over how any withdrawal agreement will be ratified at the EU level. We know that a qualified majority is needed within the Council, but it might well be that the deal has to be ratified in the individual member states' parliament. And I believe there was a report to that effect today.
That's very interesting. I mean, just a reminder, of course, that the Article 50 is literally it's the divorce agreement, really, and the
There is a separation within Article 50 between the withdrawal agreement and the future relationship that the withdrawal state will have with the EU. And there is, a sharp division of view between those who argue that there should be a quickie divorce, mm-hmm. and those who argue that the withdrawal agreement should do a lot to signal what the future relationship will be. And I think a lot of the worries that even Theresa May has been expressing about a cliff come from the idea that we will suddenly leave and all the relationships will come to nothing.
Yeah. Now, one of our listeners, Matt Moore, has written in to point out that in his view, if there is, for example, to be a referendum on the final deal, then the 2-year countdown clock will keep running during that time. Julian, is that true? Would we essentially sort of run out of time?
Well, I mean, Article 50 says that the deal has to be done within 2 years, unless all the other 27 agree. Now, some people moot that the other 27 might agree. For myself, I think that's pretty unlikely. I don't see these negotiations being conducted in a convivial, friendly spirit. I think they are probably likely to be conducted as divorce negotiations very often are, in increasing fury and acrimony. The idea that the 27 will agree at the end of 18 months or 2 years strikes me as being rather unlikely. I think things are going to get worse rather than better. But Michel Barnier said that the deal needed to be tied up not within the 2 years provided for by Article 50, but in 18 months so that member states could ratify. And moreover, only yesterday, David Davis, speaking in Parliament, said that he thought that the agreement would be tied up in 18 months as well. Now, that does leave 6 months. And if you were to ask a constitutional lawyer how long it would take to fight and run a referendum campaign, the sort of figure they'd give you would be 6 months or even slightly less. Mm. So it does look as though, deliberately or inadvertently, you'd have to ask David Davis that, the government is leaving space for the possibility of the public having another say on the precise terms upon which we leave the European Union.
It could, yes, a second referendum could possibly happen. Jennifer, I mean, there's a big tendency, obviously, on this side of the channel to kind of assume that, you know, well, as Theresa May has so often said, Brexit means Brexit. In other words, Britain can define what Brexit means. But, you know, we really need to understand that in many ways, Brexit means Brexit actually means Brexit means what the EU 27 think Brexit should mean. Up until this stage, they've been really remarkably united, and they've kept the positions, kept to the very firm positions that were stated practically on the morning that the referendum result was known. No negotiation without notification, the four freedoms indivisible, all that kind of stuff. How likely is that unity to remain once the talks actually get underway?
Yes, I think that is a very interesting question, because, as you say, their unity has so far been really quite remarkable and surprised even diplomats here how united they've managed to remain. But I think that will be put to the test once we get into negotiations properly. So from the spring, and once the EU27 have to agree their own negotiating mandate, because then we'll start to run into all those difficult questions about money and power. And I think it will be especially difficult when we get to talking about the budget, because if the UK, and once the UK leaves the EU, it will mean that in order to maintain current levels of spending, the current big payers, Germany, Sweden, for instance, will have to put more into the EU budget. And that will raise all sorts of tensions. We'll also see a division over how to manage Brexit and how far to press the UK and how much people want a transition agreement or not. So I think that unity could start to fray once we get to the spring. But on the other hand, there's also a common interest in keeping the EU together, in keeping the project going, and that will be what the EU institutions will try to guarantee.
I mean, I guess the bottom line for the EU is really quite straightforward, which is, as Michel Barnier said, really, which is that the one thing that the EU27 and the institutions have to ensure is that Brexit produces a worse deal for Britain than membership of the EU, basically.
Yes, and the Brexit negotiations won't be happening in a vacuum, of course. You'll have the French elections, German elections in the autumn. So EU leaders will be very conscious of their own electoral threats and ensuring that Britain doesn't get a deal that makes it look as if leaving the EU is better than remaining. Yeah. So I think that will be a sort of powerful countervailing force to try to keep that unity in place.
To pull them together, exactly. Julian, once Article 50 is in motion, that also means that there's basically kind of a two-year countdown on British citizens' EU, or British nationals' EU citizenship. Is that something that they could possibly challenge as individuals, British citizens who were alarmed at or upset at the prospect of losing their EU citizenship?
It's not something that happens when we trigger Article 50. It's something that's happening already. So only last night I saw an advertisement on a European website. I'm not looking for a job. It was pointed out to me by an academic that was advertising for lawyers who were citizens of the remaining 27. So already people are being discriminated against. They are in effect losing rights consequential upon our intention to depart. Certainly, it will be asserted that the loss of citizenship rights is something justiciable in law. There are a slew of further challenges waiting in the wings beyond those that have already been launched. I should say that none of them are mine, but I do speak to other lawyers who say there are other points that they want to take.
But in your view, there are prospects for any Article 50 deal when it finally emerges to be challenged in the courts, even in 2019, Owen?
I think that this is one of the many unknowns that will dog the process as it goes through. And certainly, as well as Joe's case and the Supreme Court case, we know already a group called British Influence is launching a case to argue that even when we leave if we do, the EU, we will remain in EFTA, the free trade agreement area, and effectively, therefore, in the single market. And that case is likely to come to the British courts, they expect, next March, February or March. So there could be many more actions in the wings, and that could certainly affect the process of negotiation.
Are you likely to be involved, Julian, or have you got enough on your plate already?
I never have enough on my plate. We, in Ireland, also intend to take this point about whether by leaving the EU, you automatically also fall out of the EEA. It's a very, very important point, particularly for the Irish, because if you have a freedom of movement across the island of Ireland, then many of the problems associated with imposing a hard border and the impact of that hard border upon the Good Friday Agreement are likely to be avoided. I'm not wildly optimistic about a challenge based on the loss of citizenship rights succeeding, but I'm sure somebody will bring one. The other point that I want to make is this. If the government does want to avoid this slew of legal challenges, there will also be further challenges, I have no doubt, from the devolved assemblies, it really does need to recognise that it cannot steamroller everything. The rights of UK citizens living abroad, the rights of EU citizens living here, the interests of the devolved assemblies, the unity of the United Kingdom going forward, all of those things cannot be made sacrificial lambs, I'm mixing my metaphors, to achieve this result of Brexit means Brexit, whatever Brexit means.
Mm. Philip, do you see any further legal challenges down the road?
I think it's inevitable that there will be. These issues are very, very important. People feel very strongly about it, and the courts are one mechanism that it is possible to use in order to try and swing events your way. But the one thing I was going to mention there is that I interestingly spent a lot of yesterday reading some of the House of Lords European Committee reports which are coming out. Mm. So these are about the prospects for trade, about acquired rights, about passporting rights in the city. And they include quite a damning indictment of the government's position and how ill thought through the government's position is. They seem to be suggesting that all manner of the dimensions of the problem haven't properly been considered at government level and express strong scepticism about the ability of the government to achieve the things that it seems to want to achieve.
Yeah, so it seems the Article 50 challenge may be just the beginning. Well, we're going to have to stop there, I'm afraid. But of course, this discussion is going to rage on well into the new year. We'd like to hear from you. Please leave your comments on the podcast page or email us with suggestions of what aspects of Brexit we should focus on next. If you're an EU national living in Britain or a Brit living elsewhere in the EU, we would definitely like to hear from you because that's what we are going to be looking at in our next episode. Please get in touch at brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. And that's just about all for this episode of Brexit Means. My thanks to Jolyon Maugham, Owen Bocott, Jennifer Rankin and Philip Serpice. The producers were Phil Maynard and Rowan Slaney. I'm John Henley, and thank you very much for listening. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
The Guardian.